Never in the history of the broadcasting media has the morale standard of a newscaster been lower. Here comes the Colonel.
Oh, yeah, just when we get everything under control around here, somebody sneaks in from the studio down the hall where they're producing and auditioning for Comedy Central. Oh, they drive us crazy around here. Well, welcome back. The second half of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network, exploring the business of emerging science, open innovation. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. Right now, we're covering the speakers that are going on at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference going on in Boston, May 10th, 11th, and 12th at the Westin Hotel. Our guest this second half of the program is going to be Han Liu. She is the professor and graduate program director of the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth. And then we're going to go to Israel and talk to Yonatan Shaham. His modeling urban fires in Mediterranean and Middle Eastern cities will be most interesting. But right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set for today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information.
Yes.
Oh, can I help you?
Yes. I see we have awakened the spirit of the fountain, who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for a price. That's why we had to throw in the coins. All right, oh, spirit of the fountain, here's one for you. Put on your thinking cap and go back to 1879. All right, oh, spirit of the fountain. What was the very most, that you could pay for a single item at a Woolworth store in 1879? The most costly thing in Woolworths in 1879. What was it, oh spirit of the fountain?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell me.
The spirit of the fountain really does know all, hear all, see all, and tell. Well, if you figured out that Woolworth's store, at least in 1879, was a 5- and 10-cent store. You got it. Yeah, the most expensive thing at a Woolworth's store in 1879 was 10 cents. All right, back to our program. Yeah, that's great. The music of the Science News Network Studio Band. Okay, in the previous half hour, we heard from Dr. Han Liu, Professor and Graduate Program Director, Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth, who was talking about all the fuss. First of all, let's remind you that she's making a presentation at this year's IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference going on in Boston, May 10th, 11th, and 12th. And she's going to, her message is going to be message authentication in driverless cars. And we're covering that pretty good. But we're also very interested in her views, because last year she spoke of cybersecurity endpoint authentication. And she sees a utopian future where the internet prevents crime because of lack of privacy makes us all behave. I'm a little concerned about whose behavior, who decides what behavior is right behavior. But she seems to think that it's pretty clearly universally understood. Anyway, we're going to get back with her. We're talking about the iPhones and about the FBI's tuss with Apple in getting in a back door. And she said that's not the problem at all. And she said there's a number of things the FBI could be doing. And she mentioned there's a fourth one. So we wanted to cover that in more detail. So here she is.
The fourth method is that, okay, the FBI, because FBI owns the phone, then we can duplicate the signal in that phone. Okay? If that's a very hard way to do, but there's a way, there will be some way to duplicate the phone, and instead of breaking the phone itself, which has a guard dog, and we could break the duplicate device.
Yeah?
Yeah, but all the problem is that because there's a time, this is people's life, and there's some covered that might be on loose, that might cause more danger. So they have a way that Apple has to help FBI to buy the time at this moment. Because, as I said, as the time goes, the method that Apple put down will be broken. Every time someone declares, this is the history of security encryption, every time someone declares, I invented some kind of mechanism or device or some kind of protocol, it's unbelievable. It's a make a joke of themselves. It will be broken. That's a history. Think about the famous history in World War II, the Germans' Enigma machine, right? And that from that, the way to break Enigma machine that come out, the new technology, which is the computer. So I've been saying, when the people try to break down the Apple's security methods, there will be new method, and that new mechanism could be another another revolution of modern revolution of technology.
Yeah, you referenced the Enigma, and that's right. That was one of the great coups of the Second World War, is to break the Enigma code. But but you're also saying that with this guard dog, that there are people around the world working on being able to eliminate the guard dog without permission from Apple. So even that is not going to be the final solution for privacy. Is that right?
Exactly. Because, as I said, this is just time. When the FBI asks Apple to do is try to use the law enforcement and resource to buy the time.
Mm-hmm.
As the time goes, the Apple's method of guard dog will be removed.
Well,
actually, I've been talking with my students, our security group have a regular Tuesday lunch, we call the working lunch time, and we talk about it, that there's a way to take the guard dog away. In theory, it's just a time of setting. You think about it, count 10 times, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just a general metaphor for anybody to understand it, not in the computer technology and details. If that's a counter, count 10 times. If they don't run, and the guard dog will chase all the evidence away. And now you could stop the timer.
Okay.
That's the basic philosophy.
Yeah, that'd be the next step, to stop the timer and make it 100 times or 500 times or something of that nature. When we spoke last year, you felt that endpoint authentication will give us kind of a utopian future where the internet actually prevents crime. Do you still feel that way?
Yes. Right now, especially you heard about smart home, smart city. And now the whole world is being recorded. As I said, now it's not being recorded. Not to talk about just the camera to record what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And you can think about whatever you've been done is under the daylight, being recorded by the light and trapped in the black hole. If someone has the way to unleash the black hole, everything been done in the history will be revealed, all under the truth.
But this is such a loss of privacy. This is what Edward Snowden is warning us about, is that there's no longer any privacy. Everybody will know everything about my medical records, everything about my life, everything that I do. And do we really want that kind of a world?
This is true. And no matter, it's not just America. Because if America does not do it, the other countries are doing it right now. The Internet of the Things get everything, Internet of everything. Everything gets connected, and everything is being recorded. And now you see how small the cameras are, and they can place things everywhere. So that's what technology has, is a double-edged Swiss knife. It can be good, it can be bad. So that's why, we need people understand technology. We have to slow down the process. We need to understand the technology, understand impact of technology, and also the social and legal issues.
Well, it's a matter of trusting our government. I mean, what in the wrong hands of somebody like in North Korea, or maybe a despotic government like has shown itself again in Egypt. and some of these other areas where the despots want to run and own the people and cut out the liberty. Even in America, we have to worry constantly. We're a country of liberty, but we also want law and order. And to have liberty, we've got to suffer a certain amount of crime, because you can't have a country of liberty without some sort of crime. Don't you agree?
Yes, I agree. That's why I remembered back to you about 30 years ago when I came to America. We're joking that, oh, wow, that I was in New York City and that we were devastating with the random crime. Then we said, oh, in America, we don't know what to do and you've been killed. But if you're in Russia, at least you know to keep your mouth shut. You know, so we know with anything come with the knowledge, there's a power.
Mm-hmm.
Anything with the power, that has to be a responsibility.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's why we, as all the computer, all the engineering people, we have a course in our school. It's the engineering ethic course. So we tell our future engineers, whatever you do, you design, you have to think the consequence to the future.
Yeah, I guess. Well, all right. When you're going to speak to us at the conference in May, the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference, what is the one big takeaway you're going to want us to take away in simple words?
In simple words, the takeaway is we should think as engineer. We have our ultimate responsibility to the society.
Okay.
Number one. Number two is that we have to abide with the moral standards. At the time when we consider our own liberty, we have to consider the harmonious of the whole society. And don't think that you can do anything wrong without being seen, especially the future technology come out. For example, the teenagers, the little kids that was in 12 or 13 years old, especially popular application like a snapshot, a disappear message. Don't think that disappear message really disappear. There's various ways the message being recorded. Even the king of snapshot, Mr. Kell himself, saved his own favorite clips as a classic. So they're not going to be disappearing. Just do the right thing, no matter who is watching or not watching.
Dr. Liu, it's such a pleasure having you on with us again. We're so excited you're going to be back with us at the Homeland Security Technology Conference. That will be May 10, 11, and 12 at the Western Hotel in Waltham, Massachusetts. And we're sure looking forward to seeing you, and thank you so much for being a guest again on this program. We will always welcome you and love having you on.
Thank you very much.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Science News Radio Network special presentation, Promise of Tomorrow, with Colonel Mason. Those of you listening on radio can also hear us commercial-free online anytime, webcast, at promiseoftomorrow.biz. And coming up, we're going to go by phone to Israel and talk to Yonatan Shaham. He's going to be making a presentation at this year's IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference titled Modeling Urban Fires in Mediterranean and Middle Eastern Cities. It is really a very, very interesting interview from right there, Johnny, on the spot. And to take us up there, how about a little bit more of the Science News Radio Network studio band? What do you say? You're listening to the Science News Radio Network program, Promise of Tomorrow, with Colonel Mason. In just a minute, we're going to go to Tel Aviv, Israel, and talk to Yonatan Shaham, who is making a special presentation at this year's IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference in Boston, Massachusetts, in May. And this time we have on the line Yonatan Shaham,
He is with Ashkenazi. I'm getting this right. He's in Tel Aviv. We caught him in Tel Aviv talking over his computer. That's the reason it's a little hard to understand him, but I hope you can listen closely. He set up scenarios team for the Israeli Fire and Rescue National Authority and is going to be presenting at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference in May, the 10th, 11th, and 12th in May in Boston, Massachusetts. And his subject is going to be modeling urban fires in Mediterranean and Middle Eastern cities. Welcome to the program, Yonatan. Tell us a little bit about this, modeling urban fires in Mediterranean and Middle Eastern cities. I know this is quite a study for you. You've been looking at human rights and political philosophy and all sorts of things for some time. But give us kind of a preview of what we're going to expect to hear when you give your talk.
Gladly, and thanks for having me on your show. For the last few years, we've been working for the Israeli National Fire and Rescue Authority, which is a new governmental body which was established only on 2012 after the Carmel Mountain fire. Mm-hmm. It was a very big fire in Israel with casualties of 34 people in total. And after that, the Israeli government decided to establish a new national fire and rescue authority instead of the municipality authorities were before. And since then, we are working with this new authority and creating all its long-term planning. And one issue that I noticed, which we don't have a good knowledge about, is how to fight fires in multiple ignition scenarios, like after an earthquake or during a war. If you take Haifa, for example, in the city of Haifa, which is the largest city in northern Israel, you have about one or two fires each day.
But oh, really?
The war scenario after, yeah.
One or two but fires. One or two fires each day. Is this caused by terrorist attacks, or is this just a matter of being an urban city?
Yeah, just normal fires, construction fires.
Okay.
But if you take, for example, the case of an earthquake or a war with rocket launching, you will have 10 times or even 100 times more fires each day. And, of course, in this scenario, firefighters cannot utilize their normal strategies, and they have to find new strategies to fight these fires. So the first thing you need to do in order to research such scenarios and to understand them is, of course, to understand how does the fire spread in our cities. And our cities, the Israeli cities, are an exemplify of cities all over the Mediterranean and the Middle Eastern region. In our region, there is almost no rain in the summer. You can have up to 8 months with no rain at all. And you have unflammable constructions in most of the cities, and a lot of vegetation and man-planted vegetation between the buildings in order to overcome the hot summer. So what happens is that the vegetation between buildings acts as an accelerator for fire spread. And what we will present at the conference on May is the work of me and my supervisor, Professor Tracker Benenson, which we adopted general rules of simulating fire spread that were developed from the U.S., and we implemented them and changed them to fit the Israeli and the Mediterranean and Middle Eastern context.
Okay, so let me kind of clarify what I think you said, is that you go 8 months at a time without any rain, and the buildings are not all made to be really fire resistant, so they can go up pretty easily, and then the vegetation that grows will get dry and be conductive to the spreading of fires, and so you have to take some pretty serious measures in how to prevent the fires from spreading. But I understand that Israel has been extremely good in desalinating seawater and so in irrigation and that sort of thing. Isn't that kind of helping redress the problems?
It helps to some extent, but it counters it in another, because most of the vegetation in Israeli cities, and again, it's the same for all over the region, is man-planted vegetation, because there's almost no, you could say 10% of the vegetation is natural. So what happens, you have streets with vegetation planted all across them, and fire, which starts in one building, which spreads to the other building through the vegetation. You can say that our ability to desalinate water enables us to irrigate all this vegetation, which in every normal day, this helps us to overcome the very arid climate that we have. In such cases, firefighters need to take into attention the effect of vegetation in such scenarios.
Okay. So what are the solutions that you're going to be showing at the conference?
We will present our method to estimate and to simulate the fire spread, and we will use this to create risk maps of different cities in Israel. We are currently doing it for Haifa City. And the next stage will be to develop a simulation of the response of firefighters in such scenarios. We also plan to engage firefighter officers in Israel with the simulation in a game-like manner. And this will allow us to identify strategies which can be used in such situations and to assess them and to help the firefighters to develop new strategies.
Okay. So, and these applications that are developed in Israel can also be transferable, I guess, to any other Arab area, arid area. I didn't mean to say Arab area, arid area in the Middle East or any other place in the world where fires can spread for lack of moisture. Is that right?
Yes, we hope so.
Okay. So you want to spread the ideas. Okay, good. All right, that's excellent. Well, we're going to look forward to seeing you at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference, May 10th through the 12th at the Westin Hotel in Waltham, Massachusetts. That's Boston. And we're kind of honored to have you arrive from Israel and give us the benefit of the inside information that you're going to have for modeling urban fires in Mediterranean and Middle Eastern cities. Is there anything that I forgot to ask you that we've missed?
I don't think so, and thanks for having me. I just want to take the opportunity to put in a good word for firefighters in Israel and all over the world who risk their lives to save our lives every day.
All right, so good of you. Yonatan Shaham, who's with Ashraf Ashkenazi, head of scenarios team for the Israeli Fire and Rescue National Authority, the National Emergency Management Authority, Ministry of Public Security, and municipalities, talking to us from Tel Aviv. So glad to have you with us today, and we look forward to seeing you at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference in May. Thanks so much for being with us, Yonatan.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we caught up with Yonatan Shaham in Tel Aviv, in Israel. You've been listening to the special presentation by the Science News Radio Network, PromiseOfTomorrow.biz, with Colonel Mason. And we're covering the special events and speakers that are going on at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference in Boston, Massachusetts, May 10th through 12th. And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to the this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
Just keep reading, keep thinking. It's a dynamic world, and the way to be successful is to keep learning and thinking about your place in the food chain and trying to move yourself forward, with some analytic thought as well as just your instinct and your heart. My name is Dr. Richard Adler. I'm the president of Decision Path, a software company in the Boston area.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
Waiting for you.